Today between 3 and 4 o'clock, Fresh Air's music critics John Zwett and Francis Davis remember Monk in a special program about his compositions and musicianship. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is novelist David Bradley, whose latest novel, The Cheneysville Incident, has been nominated for the 1981 Penn Faulkner Award for the most distinguished work of fiction published by an American writer in 1981. Bradley grew up in western Pennsylvania, where he learned the legends surrounding the 13 graves near Cheneysville. The story went that the 13 men and women had escaped from slavery through the Underground Railroad, and when they learned that they were about to be recaptured, they asked to be killed rather than taken, and someone obliged. In his novel, the main character tries to find out the real story behind these 13 graves. Bradley's 1975 novel was South Street, about a young middle-class black man discovering a very different kind of culture in the bars of Philadelphia's South Street. Bradley is an assistant professor of English at Temple University and a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. He teaches, in addition to his courses in the English department, a course on publishing. He's also going to be one of the featured speakers this Saturday at a day that's going to be called Writers Talk to Writers, a forum for establishing a Philadelphia writers' organization. And this discussion, which will feature a number of writers based in Philadelphia, will be this Saturday at the Free Library on 19th and Ben Franklin. And the Cheneysville Incident is published by Harper & Row. David Bradley, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
What was your personal connection to this story of the 13 graves near Cheneysville?
Well, it was sort of tenuous to begin with. I grew up in Bedford, which is 20 miles north of Cheneysville, and knew nothing about this tale. I knew about the Underground Railroad. Everybody talked about that a little bit, but knew nothing about this particular story until 1969, when my mother, who was at that time, well, she's not a trained historian yet, but has become one pretty much, was involved in writing the history of black people in Bedford County for the bicentennial, the county bicentennial. And she came upon this story, and she asked me about it, and I said, I never heard of it. She eventually was able to track down not only the story, but it tracked them down to a hillside near Cheneysville where there are graves and so forth. And she called me up and told me, yes, it was true, and yes, these people were there. And I was, you know, I said, wow, you know. Here I grew up and knew nothing about such a story. And my connection was really that I didn't understand how anybody might prefer death to anything. I mean, my basic idea about death and about everything is that you take somebody with you if there's no way out. You know, you don't do this. And so it took me some years to come to a point where I began to understand what those people must have been thinking about, what they had actually gone through.
So I guess that entailed some research about slavery and about what it was that would make them choose death rather than a return to it.
I didn't understand how anything could be that bad. And I think mostly we don't understand. I mean, I had gone through the public educational system and had the same idea of history as I think most people have. And I spent a lot of time finding out that most of it was wrong, that there had been a lot of lies told, and that mostly the real color, I hate to use the word, but that's the real depth of what the slave experience was, is something that, you know, I don't think even yet we can comprehend. We talk about how bad things are in Poland, and we're talking about something that was far more pervasive than that.
So where did you go to find out what you needed to know for your novel?
I started reading books and very quickly found out that the only real source of anything were documents. That when somebody writes a book, they tend to leave things out or to reemphasize things, and that by reading documents, and this isn't really history because history has to do with sort of putting things in context, but what I was doing was looking at things out of context. When one man, for example, named Abraham Camp, who lived near the Wabash River in 1818, wrote a letter saying that he would rather just leave the country. Now, maybe the things that he saw weren't valid, but to him it was very valid, and that particular document meant a lot to me.
Did the documents have the kind of emotion to it that was in part what you were looking for?
Yeah, there were some documents were anonymous. I use some of them in the book. The ones that are anonymous, I sort of attributed to one of the characters in the book. But there were some very, very eloquent documents written, a lot of them about Philadelphia, about the riots that went on here and that sort of thing. And these people were screaming. You know, it's just something that gets denatured when you put it in a history book.
Well, the main character in your novel also becomes a self-styled historian and also tries to find out what happened with these 13 graves. Was his method of examining that question and your method at all similar?
Well, he's a really trained historian. He's, you know, got his PhD in history, and he teaches history in a university and all of that. So his methods start out being pretty formal. I mean, he uses note cards and stuff like that, and the kinds of things that historians really do. Eventually, he ends up making things up, which is pretty much what I do. So through the book, he sort of become his method becomes my method.
I'd like to read just a couple of lines from your novel.
Hope they're good ones.
Why don't I ask you to read it? Is that okay? Starting at the bottom of the page here.
I hope I recognize these. Maybe, you know, things change in copy editing. For this is what one must do if one would understand. One must forget apparent causes, ignore apparent motivations. For things are rarely as simple or as complicated as they appear. And the only truth, and that only a degree of truth, lies in the simple statement of the incident. In the year of our Lord, 1948, a child was born to Yvette Stanton Washington, wife of Moses Washington. One would say it that way because one can be convinced, but never absolutely certain, that a woman's husband is the father of her child.
Is that the approach that you took when you were going back to history of just trying to examine facts without putting any kind of larger meaning or context into them?
It was something I had to do because most of the history that I knew and that I think most people know is interpreted history. And I had to stop and say, okay, now this happened. And if you can prove or at least give some sort of evidence that it happened, then you start from there. And you don't try to figure out right then and there exactly what it meant. And you certainly don't listen to what anybody tells you. We, for example, believed that the war between the states was fought over the matter of slavery. Well, that's pretty well debunked now, but it wasn't when I was in the sixth grade. And if I had known what I know now, things would have been a lot easier for me.
Your main character is a historian who at some point tries to use his imagination to understand what has happened and can't really get it to function very well. And you're a novelist who's trying to use the tools of an historian to learn what you need to for your novel. What did you learn about the differences and similarities between history and fiction?
The first thing I learned, of course, I've pretty much known that, was that you can't lie as much in fiction as you can in history.
You want to explain that?
Well, there were some incredibly bizarre things that went on in history that you can tell people about and they'll believe because it's historical. You can prove it. It's a fact. But if you made them up, they would, you know, they simply wouldn't believe it. Or you document an atrocity, and atrocities tend to be far more atrocious than anybody can truly imagine. And unless it's real, nobody will believe it because they'll accuse you of prurient interest or something, you know. There was one incident that was mentioned in the book having to do with the slave trade, and a British merchantman threw his slaves overboard and filed for the insurance and got it and was convicted not of murder but of insurance fraud. I mean, you know, this is something that only – I mean, it sounds like black comedy, no pun intended. And in fact, it's history. It's only funny because it's real.
So what do you do to make that more palpable and vivid?
Well, first of all, you have to cut things down a lot. when you're writing fiction, you have to take the historical fact and cut out a lot of the real truth and make it somehow – I mean, we can't really comprehend the size of the slave trade is something we can't comprehend. I can't even remember the numbers anymore because it was just so huge. It went on such a long time, and it was so deep. And, you know, in fiction, you know, you can sort of clean things up a little bit. Roots on TV was an example in which slave cabins didn't look that neat. But, you know, it was bad enough. You know, nobody was going to accept the way that it really looked. So that's one of the things that fiction does. It sort of gives you a denatured view of reality.
I've seen some, like, docudrama type things on television where the writers swore that what they were doing was really making sense of history for us. But it seemed like such fictitious history that I felt that at best it was going to confuse everyone about what really happened and what the writers imagined happened. Where do you draw the line for yourself or for others in the docudrama area or the fiction based on history?
Well, I don't really have to because I don't like those things where somebody invents dialogue that they didn't have access to. I mean, if you're going to write fiction, then, you know, write fiction. Don't hide behind it. My problem in this book was, I mean, I used the facts until the facts ran out, and then I felt free to invent. Like I said, there were documents. I wanted one of the characters back in history who have been a writer of sorts. And so I looked around until I found anonymous documents that I could say that he had written rather than change, you know. To talk about fiction, that's one thing. To talk about, well, this is really not fiction, but it's really not fact. And we sort of, you know, it seems to me you ought to come out of the closet and say what you're doing. And, if it loses validity because it's not true, then you ought not to do it.
Does slavery seem less distant now than it did before, if it did before? I mean, just in terms of years, less far away?
One of the things I've learned is that, if you reduce... I did absorb some of the historical methods and some of the way that people think, not only from writing the book, from my father, who was a historian. But to look at the patterns, you look at patterns of things and you see that slavery still goes on. Some of its essential structures still exist, the welfare system being a very prime example. That whole idea of paternalism, of blacks being unable to take care of themselves, and that some of our best, quote-unquote, best motivations in the 60s and so forth were really just restructurings of basic slavery days ideas. So it doesn't seem less distant. In fact, it seems I think we could probably do a lot towards ending it if we don't start. But it still goes on. And, it actually does go on. There are brands of slavery going on. But in the larger terms, in terms of the form of the institution, it still goes on, which is a little – I mean, that's not really surprising. I mean, it lasted for a long time.
We'll get back to your opinions of the welfare program and
okay, if you want.
In a little while. You grew up in the area around Cheneysville, right?
Yeah, 20 miles away.
There wasn't a very large black community there, I don't
know.
No,
the county is Bedford County, and the county seat is Bedford. I lived about 2 miles outside of town. There were about, let's say less than 100 blacks there throughout the time that I grew up. And the population in the town itself was about 5,000 people. The county was larger, 25,000, something like that. So a very small percentage of population.
Was there a black neighborhood within the town?
There was, but not – there were really two, and they had sort of spread out. It wasn't as – in the book, it's all concentrated in one area. There was a hill there, as there is in the book, and people did have a problem there not being no indoor plumbing for a while and so forth and so on. But it wasn't as concentrated as it is in the book. But the pattern, I might say, is similar throughout most of western Pennsylvania, southwestern Pennsylvania anyway. So I used a lot of towns to put together the town in the book, which is never identified.
Was that area a place within the Underground Railroad?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, as much of the history as I could use is true. Yeah, it was, I could point out sites of butcher shop. One butcher shop was a stop and so forth and so on.
Yeah, so how did that affect the way the town grew and what was in it?
It didn't really affect... it's an old town. It's a very old town. It was established in 1757. And it was a very small percentage of the population, percentage-wise, of people of the Underground Railroad even moving through because it was a very dangerous route. The sentiments, at least the southern part of the county, were not such as to make that kind of activity very profitable. So nobody did it. It was probably the most dangerous route in the Underground Railroad, which is why I don't hear about it.
You can tell me if this is a kind of appropriate generalization or not, but I always think of most black people who grew up in rural areas grew up in the South, and most black people in the North have grown up in cities. This is the way I always think of it, just as,
I don't know, but I'd say it was true. I mean, there weren't a lot of black people running around western Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Did you feel like kind of an outsider in a way from like northern black politics? Because they've been so urban in focus.
Well, there were... It became a fashionable thing in the late 60s, mid-60s to be an urban black. And that did mean that I was not very well understood. Like when I came to Penn, it was, my experience had been different. And the overtone of that time was that if you hadn't gone hungry and you hadn't, kicked rats out of your bed, then you hadn't been oppressed. I don't think that's true, although I never went hungry. But it's just, it's a different kind of experience. I spent some time in the South traveling with my father. It was, that wasn't the same, that southern rural experience wasn't the same as mine either.
Did you feel like a real northerner when you were in the South?
No, I sort of wished I was a southerner. It's difficult to explain, but the South was a far more hospitable place in certain ways. It was a more honest place in terms of, the signs were still up when I went down there, or they'd just taken them down. And, you know, you see signs that say, they didn't really say colored, they said whites only. The same kind of situation was going on in my hometown. I couldn't get my hair cut there, for example. That's the most salient one. But there were no signs. It was just that everybody knew and nobody went in there and nobody would really say why. There was one snack bar, coffee shop that you didn't go into, and you never went out and tried to use the swimming pool. There were jobs that you would be fired from or that you couldn't have if you were black. One woman, you know, passed in order to be a hostess at a dining room. She could have been a waitress, but not a hostess. So there were these little things going on that nobody would talk about, whereas in the South, this is the way it was, and everybody knew it, and everybody mentioned it. And it was sort of comforting, because instead of having to constantly feel your way, like walking through a minefield, you know where the mines are, you know, there were signs. There is a mine here. Don't step on it. It'll blow you up. You know, it was a different kind of experience. It's very good.
Do you think that those white people in the luncheonette or in the barbershop where you couldn't get your hair cut would be outspoken against segregation in the South if they were asked?
Oh, I'm sure they were. You know, that's one of the things that was operating, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s was this myth of the good Northern white. Martin Luther King pounded on that very heavily. And one of the reasons that things happened was because Northern whites were so satisfied by the idea that there were these nasty white people in the South who were actually beating up on blacks instead of just sticking them in ghettos. You know,
must have really limited your social life, because one of the
my what?
Well, one of the real complaints of most people who grew up in small towns is that everybody knows everybody's business, and it's hard to meet new people, and you only have a very limited number of potential friends to draw on, and it's hard enough to find people who you feel simpatico with to begin with. But you were only probably okay to draw from a very small percentage of the overall population of your friends.
The year I graduated from high school, there were two blacks in the class. Myself, the male, and there was a girl, which everybody thought was, I mean, somebody actually said to me, gee, isn't that nice for you? Wouldn't it be terrible if you were both, you know, males? It didn't make any difference because she didn't much like me and, you know, you know, forget it. So it was, you know, it was sort of funny, but, yeah, you know, things went on. Things still go on. It's a different place today.
You said that when you were starting your book, you really needed to figure out how someone could choose death over life, no matter what that life was. Was right with when you finished the book, did you feel like you were closer to that answer?
I understand it, I think, for those people. I understand that their ideas of what death was are a little different. And I understand, I mean, slavery is something that it's really difficult for you and I. I mean, we're talking about people, the North Star, for example, that being a symbol. The importance of that was that people were not allowed to know what North was. I mean, just the four directions, North, South, East, and West, this was information that was denied them. So we're not talking about people who weren't allowed to learn how to read. We were talking about people who were denied, you know, some basic physical orientation. And it went on and on and on. The fact that a slave was not allowed to own any kind of property. I mean, you couldn't go down to the corner candy store and buy candy, if there was such a thing, because you couldn't handle money and you couldn't buy the candy. You begin to understand where things come from. And I can understand a little better, knowing how deep, you know, how deeply things ran. But I still don't comprehend it, really.
I guess it's not something you really want to completely empathize with.
Well, no, not really, you know. But it's a long way, I think, than what we think of as normal oppression. I mean, we think of people who want to do something and who are prevented from doing it. And we have to talk about a group of people who were not even allowed to know they wanted to do it. You know, that's pretty oppressed.
Right. What kind of form did you choose to write your story?
Well, I didn't really know how to do it. I started out writing straight historical kind of novel. What really now is the last maybe two chapters in the book. And it wasn't working. It wasn't working for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons it wasn't working because there were a lot of very popular books in that type at the time. Bugleland had come out just about the time I started working on this. And I was very, very concerned about not doing anything. I mean, I didn't want to waste this material. Secondly, I realized that a book that drew on what people already knew about history would fail, because knowing what people already knew about history, this incident was not comprehensible. You simply couldn't understand it. So I had to come up with some vehicle by which to get the historical facts across in some sort of palatable form without, you know, boring everybody with a recitation of history. That's where the character of the historian developed. But then I also wanted to make it clear that these were things that had effect today and to force him to deal with it. So that's how come he has a girlfriend or a lover, whatever we call it. It's, I never know what word to use. And the reason she's white is because if she weren't white, he wouldn't have to deal with it. That's, you know, so things sort of grew in that way. Then I had to invent ways in which he could get this material and why it would mean something to him. And then other structures developed, his crazy father and his weird mother and his dead brother and stuff like that.
I had read that you said that one of the books that you thought of while writing this was Moby Dick. What was the connection for you?
Well, Moby Dick, to this day, was listed, or maybe not to this day, when I was there in London, was in the British Museum under Cetology as a work of nonfiction rather than a work of fiction.
What's Cetology?
Study of whales. And, you know, of course, there are the whaling chapters in it. And I began to look at that because there was a need for a lot of real factual information as there was in Moby Dick. And I wanted to make it organic as it more or less became in Moby Dick. And the structure of the books is similar in that Moby Dick, that chase thing, only happens in the last third of the book, and that's when things really get going. And that's what was going on here. So that was, you know, the structures are very similar.
You obviously didn't want to write a historical novel the way that term is used now, which
nope.
It means historical romance usually.
Ladies in crinoline and no. Did not want to do that.
With passion,
yes,
in the title and
yes,
in the cover.
Someplace where you can boil somebody in oil or something, you know.
Is there anything you need to do to telegraph to the potential reader in the bookstore, for instance, what the book is and what it isn't?
Well, the publishers usually take care of that with the covers, and we hope. Doesn't always happen. Not really. And there's nothing you can do in writing a book that does that. You have to rely on art departments and jacket flap copywriters and, you know, catalog writers. And if you're real lucky, people put together ads. Not everybody gets ads, though. So usually they just show a picture of the book anyway.
Well, the book has been nominated for a 1981 Penn Faulkner Award. Is that award's very significant for you? Or are you trying to, like, not think about it very much?
Well, actually, that's a very good award to be nominated for because you get paid for being nominated. You get $1,000 for being one of the nominees, and the winner gets, I think, $5,000. And, you know, everybody gets a nice trip down to Charlottesville, Virginia for, you know, I mean, it's fun. You know, who cares if you win? But, I mean, an award is something that, I mean, it's nice to sit back. It's like being on the radio even, you know, because it's not something that takes place where you're actually doing the work. So I sit back now, and it's like it's something happening to somebody else. I mean, I sort of think about that poor guy sitting in his room in New York City where I was when, you know, typing away when nobody was even calling him on the telephone. I mean, he used to sit there wishing the phone would ring, for God's sake. And, you know, now it's sort of enjoyable, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the book. It's not like I could change it or anything. I certainly didn't think Jesus would an award, you know.
The book got, I think, very good reviews from critics. So many books get published and no one even notices it.
Oh, yeah.
No one reviews it. No one stocks it in their stores. Were you concerned about that when you were first letting the book go, that nothing might happen to it?
That's always a possibility. Early on in the process, the history of the publication of this book is really strange from the point of view of the publishing industry, but I had gone through two different editors. One was fired, one had resigned. And I knew the people with whom I was dealing. I had worked for one of the guy who runs Harper & Row now. I worked for. And I basically, they had read the manuscript and so forth and so on, and I went in and said, look, I've been through two editors, and you shouldn't have to do this if you don't want to do it, and I want to know what you're going to do for the book. And we had a good time. I ended up threatening things like trashing their offices and stuff like that. And what came out of it was a commitment for 25,000 copy first printing and $25,000 in ad money, which doesn't mean a lot in terms of the ad money, but the printing does. And that was something of a guarantee that some attention would be paid to it. And that's one of the things you learn when you're involved in publishing. You learn what the important numbers are. But that was certainly a fear. And I did the best I could in fighting for that. But after that point, there's not much you can do.
David Bradley is my guest. He's a novelist who's based now in Philadelphia and is an assistant professor of English at Temple University. And his most recent novel, the one that's been nominated for the 1981 Penn Faulkner Award, is called The Cheney'sville Incident. It's very different in tone from South Street, which was about life on South Street, particularly in the many bars around South Street. Did you find, as the writer of both these books, that you were in a really different frame of mind during the writing of them?
Yeah, I mean, I had a real good time writing South Street. You know, the scenes were funny and they moved along, and it was a more open structure from a technical point of view. I got things going. It was a lot like playing jazz. This was more of a symphonic kind of thing. You had to be aware of where things were going and exactly how far, how long it was going to last and so forth. And it's a much, much more sober book. It was not as much fun. The main character is more fully drawn for lots of reasons, but he's also not quite as much fun as a guy. As a matter of fact, he's sort of obnoxious. But he's tortured, and, you spend a lot of time in somebody's head like that, and things start carrying over to your private life, and you get a little crazy.
Do you become the torturer or the torturee when you're writing about a character like
that? This one was even harder. This was the first person, and, you have to worry about talking like somebody else all the time and doing things. I mean, he has something of a sexual problem. He's very withdrawn and simply doesn't want to give himself even in that physical way. And there was a time before I knew that about him that I found myself having that problem, and I couldn't understand it until I suddenly realized it was him, not me, and then everything sort of straightened out a little bit. But, there was a weird kind of psychological transference going on, and it was, I still know things about him that nobody else knows because I didn't have room to put them in the book and they weren't important. And he's done some pretty nasty things.
I think it's important, though, to know stuff about your character that isn't going to get included, to know, like, what they did before the book and maybe even what they're going to do after it ends.
Yeah. It's one of the things I try to teach is that you can't tell all you know, but you have to know it, because otherwise that's how characters get deep. That's how you make things ring true.
Your next novel is going to be... maybe not a novel?
Maybe not the next one.
Maybe not the next one.
You're talking about the...
the Kent State one?
Yeah. Well, it's not really Kent State one because it's not based at Kent State. It's called Ohio. That's the title it has right now. Although it doesn't take place in Ohio. It takes place in Philadelphia.
I understand.
But, that incident, that Kent State event, was something that I think has meaning for a lot of people. In my generation, I think it has a very large meaning for America, because it was a time when all the laughing stopped. Nobody, up until that time, we sort of had lighthearted demonstrations, and even if you got hit over the head, well, it didn't really count. It was sort of like TV. And if somebody tells you now suddenly this is not videotape, that people are actually out there dying, and it's sort of like what happened when they put the Tet Offensive on the CBS Evening News, and everybody saw people getting shot in living color. It was like, well, oh my goodness, this really happens, Only this was even closer. So I'm sort of interested in the effect that's had on people.
How do you think you'll explore that in the novel?
Don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't know. I'm pretty sure it's going to be another first-person narrative. I'm pretty sure that the book itself takes place about 10 years after the incident, which would be a year ago, 1981. Beyond that, I know there's a lot of music involved in it, but I'm not sure exactly. I think that the 60s were all about music, and everything that was said then was really being said with music. But beyond that, I don't really know.
There's a lot of people who are doing their film and their book that is the summation of the 60s or the early 70s, and there's already been the made-for-TV movie about Kent State. As a writer, do you have to worry that people will say, oh, I read the book about that already?
Nah.
It's funny, you're part of the baby boom generation, right?
Oh, yeah, so, sure. Look at the boom right here,
It's a real mixed blessing for a writer, isn't it? Because, the things that really are important to you are probably important to a lot of other people. On the other hand, there might be a lot of other writers writing about those same important things.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's clearly something to be considered. But on the other hand, if I were worried about nonfiction, then it would be a problem. But I'm writing a book that... this book or any other book. I mean, there are a lot of books written about slavery, and the comparison is Roots, which I never read. But, you figure you're yourself and you do your own thing and you're a novelist and, you've got some weird cockamamie idea anyway. And once you've got two weird ideas that nobody's had, then things sort of proceed from that, and the logic is all different. So you end up starting from a different premise, or you start out starting from a different premise, and things get different. That's not why people read novels anyway, or at least not good ones.
Did you ever do a Roots type thing in your own family?
No.
United Citizen?
Nah. You know, I mean, I know some things about my family background, and you know, at some point it might be interesting, but not until I figure out how to write a book about it, you know, might bother.
you have an article that will be coming out probably in May in Esquire. Yeah. What's the title of it, do you know?
Not really. I think it's called Black in America or something like that.
They'll probably come up with the final title.
I don't put titles on things. Books, I put titles on things, but not magazine articles. You have to give editors something to do, otherwise they drive you crazy.
Well, one of the things that you write about in that is your opinions of the affirmative action programs and how they affected you personally and how you think that they've been operating in the country. How did they affect you personally?
Well, I mean, I was a child, talk about being a baby, but I was a child of affirmative, I was a creation of affirmative action. I was plucked up. I mean, I was in this dinky little town in western Pennsylvania with 5,000 people, usual public high school, not bad, not good, no expectations to speak of. And because of the time it was, I was suddenly able to be admitted to an Ivy League university and given money to attend an Ivy League university, which would have been a stumbling block, believe me. And things sort of proceeded from that point. And it was, you know, it was wonderful for me. You know, I mean, I would have been out there working in a factory probably, or maybe teaching in a high school or something like that and being frustrated. But one of the things that happens when you get that kind of education, or if you are lucky enough to get a good sort of that kind of education, you start looking at where things come from and what has happened. And having done that, I've begun to perceive a sort of mixed blessing about the whole affirmative action thing, because basically, and the idea in the article was basically that nothing has changed. Affirmative action is racism with a different sign applied. Instead of being black being a bad thing, it was suddenly a very good thing, which didn't alter the fact that what people were looking at was race as opposed to quality. And race is not a quality. It's a quality, but doesn't imply a certain kind of quality. It doesn't mean you're better. It doesn't mean you're worse. And what happened is, since there was affirmative action and those kinds of positive structures to deal with blackness, the old structures that, you know, elevated whiteness continued unabated. So now we say, well, we're going to cut back the money. We're going to get rid of affirmative action. We're going to get rid of welfare. We're going to get rid of busing and so forth. All these things that came into being to give society a mixed appearance, we're going to go back to the way things were in 1950, because we're cutting off the money to the, instead of ever achieving a basic change in what was going on. That was what did not happen.
Do you feel like this is a difficult time to criticize affirmative action programs, since they don't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be anything targeted for their replacement? I mean,
well, that's, you know, see, that's, this is the problem. The Reagan people who, or whoever they are, who say affirmative action doesn't work, school busing doesn't work. Well, of course school busing doesn't work. I mean, Brown versus the Board of Education was a school busing case. Mr. Brown didn't want his black kid bused to a black school past a white school. I mean, that's what it started as. But, and we know those things don't work, but the problem is, okay, they don't work. That's not an excuse not to do anything. And, you know, that's a problem. That's very difficult to deal with, because any rational person, I think, has to look at these programs and say, well, they failed for some reason or another, and we ought to do something about it. But, you know, it becomes difficult to go the second mile and say, well, we shouldn't do anything.
Probably through the affirmative action programs, a lot of people were able to enter into the middle class or become more firmly established in middle classness.
Yeah.
What effect do you think that has on people who haven't made it into the middle class? Do you think that there's...
Well, you know, the programs put some people into the middle class, and you were rewarded to the extent that you conformed to a certain image, whatever that image. At one point, it was being a ghetto black. I mean, you know, there was not a lot of money around for middle class black people at one point, you know, who were people who were already middle class. And that emphasis tended to denigrate those people who had made sacrifices who already to become middle class. So that it was a problem for those people. And once there was a sufficient number of blacks in a particular area, then those quotas or whatever they were began to operate in reverse and say, okay, we've got enough, no more. So, you know, there was never a real change in decision making. It was simply what kinds of action are going to be taken on the same decision.
Do you think that the opposition to the renewal of the Voting Rights Act and the the taking away of the giving of tax exemption to colleges with racist policies. Do you think that's representative of a new racism or of a new ability to be comfortable?
I think it's a question of turning over rocks and finding the same old toads.
Uh-huh.
That decision about not giving, not making giving tax exempt status or charitable status to racist institutions is a very, it's only been in existence for a short period of time, and there are all sorts of questions about whether or not the IRS should do such things anyway, because if they do that, they can do all kinds of other things. But I think that the people who see leadership as being fundamentally not racist, shall we say, indifferent, insensitive. I think we have a very insensitive administration who can accept such a decision and publicize it and then wonder why people are upset. It just seems there's an odd pattern emerging. We're not saying there's a conspiracy, but just an odd pattern about immigration, for example. How come it's always the Haitians who end up in the detention centers? Could it be? That's a very subtle suggestion. Perhaps one doesn't want to push it too far. But it seems that there is a certain indifference to, certainly an indifference to appearances, shall we say.
Do you find any of this operating on a more personal day-to-day level in interactions in Philadelphia, for instance? Going back to
I find people are a lot more willing to give voice to things that they may not even feel are racist, but which I do. They're a lot more willing to say, well, this has happened to you because you're black, you were lucky, you had affirmative action. There were people all along who are willing to say this, and I think in part it has to do with the economy as well. But I mean, nobody's burning crosses on my lawn, but then I don't have a lawn. They are burning crosses on people's lawn. I think the case of the young kids who were burning crosses on lawns up in Northeast or somewhere, I'm not sure exactly where. That to me is extremely frightening, not because it was the Ku Klux Klan, but because it wasn't. And 17 or 16 or 15 or 18 or however young kids do things like that because they think it's cool and because their friends are going to think it's cool. So you start wondering, well, who's telling them that it's cool?
It's never easy to figure out what you should just ignore as an isolated incident. Not even ignore, but just like put into perspective as a kind of unique, weird, almost fluke that is not indicative of the way lots of people are going to be acting and is not part of a trend that is going to be threatening. And to not pay too much attention to it, because that'll be damaging in the long run. And to what you actually should really be worrying about, because it is going to be indicative of a trend in behavior.
That's the tricky thing with incidents, trying to
find
which ones are indicative. But, there are a lot of crazy people running around doing a lot of crazy things. But on the other hand, there seem to be a lot more of them doing the same kinds of things. I was in Springfield, Missouri this last week and visited the prison hospital, federal prison hospital there. In that hospital was a man who shot a couple of black guys out in Salt Lake City who were jogging. Shot them ostensibly because they were jogging with white girls. You can't do anything while you're jogging anyway. But, his mother supposedly gave an interview and said, oh, yeah, he's done that before, So things, you're talking tip of the iceberg and things emerge. And we're not talking about somebody killing 2 blacks or 20 blacks or 500 blacks. We're really talking about what kind of response that's met with. And the responses or lack of responses are somewhat frightening.
Hmm. David Bradley is my guest, and he's a novelist. His novels are South Street and a new novel, pretty new, came out earlier in 1981. It's called The Cheneysville Incident, and it's been nominated for the 1981 Penn Faulkner Award. South Street is out of print now, I believe.
South Street's out of print now. We keep fighting with paperback publishers, but they all want very strange things.
You've been in the publishing industry as an editor.
Yeah.
And you're also working, of course, as a writer, which has put you on either side of the fence at different parts of your career. What do you think of the Writers' Congress and of the idea of a possible writers' union?
I'm not sure about I'm going to be interested on Saturday to hear the arguments for those who, think that we can get a hardcore union like the writers, screenwriters in Los Angeles and so forth. I think it's going to be very difficult to do that sort of thing. I think there are important things for a Writers' Congress or something like that to do. I belong to the Authors Guild, which is an organization of writers, book writers, The only trouble is that in order to get into the Authors Guild, you have to write a book, which sort of means that you have to get, you know, gone over once before they can start protecting you from getting gone over again. The Authors Guild is active in things like copyright reform and that sort of thing, contract review, what is standard, informational sorts of things. This is something that a Writers Congress can do for people who are not yet published, who probably need the information more. But I think the most important thing for a group like that to do is to provide or try to provide some sort of basis for books to be edited, for writers to be helped. Because what happens in publishing is that we're talking money now. We're talking as the interest rates go up, the length of time that an author has in advance becomes of great concern. And so there are many, many books now being published simply because before they're ready. The editors don't have the time. It's not built into the structure. The financial people want the book published, and nobody's ever been able to prove that a better written book sells better than it would have. So as a result, we're getting a lot of bad books, and it's a tragedy, not because they're bad books, but they're simply books that have not been gone over one more time or two more times and rewritten to the point where they would be very good. And I think this is a problem that kind of group can address. There are other problems in publishing.
Yeah, I should mention that anyone who's interested in the question of a possible writers' union might be wanting to attend this discussion Saturday at the Free Library, and David will be one of the speakers there. It's at the Free Library this Saturday on the Ben Franklin Parkway and 19th Street. Do you think that the economics of the publishing industry and conglomerate-owned publishing companies are limiting the opportunities of writers?
No. They're limiting the opportunities of some writers. They're making more opportunities for others. The conglomerates don't seem to have had a whole lot of impact on how publishing decisions are made. They've made certain amounts of money available that weren't available before, and that's about it. They've changed not very much the people who are involved in publishing, same old people who move around, you know, the same patterns in the industry. Paperback publishing has become a bigger thing, in part because of conglomerates. That's something they can deal with, but hardcover publishing hasn't changed that much. Because of the conglomerates, it's changed, but not because of that.
Have you ever asked yourself if you were an editor, if you would have published your novels?
Oh, I never asked myself. I mean, you know, one of the things that happens, I worked down here at J.B. Lippincott Company when Lippincott was independent then, reading manuscripts. My job was to read the Over the Transom or Slush Pile, and I won't tell you what else they call it. And in about 9 months, I read about 1,000 manuscripts. And then I went up to New York for another almost 2 years, and read a lot of stuff that came in from agents, but, you know, a lot of manuscripts. I have met, I know, people whose manuscripts I have rejected. I have seen some of them published. Some of them I felt should have been published. Some of them I felt never should have been published. You know, that's just something you live with. But you're always making decisions for your own publishing house anyway. You can always hide behind that. But there's a lot of stuff that just shouldn't be published anyway.
How much did you read before determining whether you should stop or not? Did you give it a certain number of pages no matter what?
No, I always read the first page and the last page. I read until I became convinced that this was not going to be pulled out, that the things that had to happen weren't going to happen. It was a lot easier with nonfiction. Sometimes you didn't even need to just look to the subject. I mean, I had one submission, a guy who had taught his parakeet to speak or something like that. I mean, it just was not a market for that book.
Hey, I'm really interested.
You know, well, yeah, but you're only one. You know, I got to find 7,000 people and find how to reach them. It was more difficult with fiction. But, you know, it's really not that difficult because most of the time the books don't sell. And I had authority to say no from the moment I walked through the door and took my job and, you know, did so.
Since there is this emphasis on the first and the last page, do you try to pack a lot into your first page? Are you very
No,
well,
see, I don't really have to deal with that problem anymore. I'm smart enough to have an agent, but it's. I mean, if the first page is dynamite, then you read the second page, and then you get disappointed. I mean, it's not like, you know, that's all you read.
Do you think readers read that way too? Not the last page. Readers usually try not to read the last page. I guess
I don't know how readers read. I mean, I've had people say things to me that I think they thought were good things about this book or South Street or whatever. And I was devastated by the compliments in some cases. Like people have said to me, gee, you know, I really like the book. I just think it's tremendous and wonderful. But now at the end, is this what really happens? And to me, if you get to the end of a book and you know what happened, you know, then somebody has failed. And I, you know, that upsets me. But that's happened. You know, and then they say they love the book. Well, okay. I've also had people who knew exactly what happened and hated it, so maybe it's better the other way. But for me, it's you know, it's more important that, everybody understand. So,
I've spoken to publishers who think that writers make unreasonable demands on them.
Oh, sure.
And many writers who think that publishers are unreasonable in what they're willing or not willing to do for writers. There's this constant feeling that the other party is the bad guy. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those generalizations hold up on either end?
Sure. Same way that labor management negotiations or, you know, employer negotiations. I mean, it's the same basic thing. You're not after the same things. I'm after Harper and Row or whatever, whoever my publisher is, spending money to publish my book and doing it well, putting it in a nice package and so forth. They're into making a lot of money on all books. So, for example, the Book of the Month Club, which bought the rights to this Cheneysville, decided after they had sold their printing not to reprint. People have said to me, gee, this has happened. It was, you know, the Times and so forth and so on. And having been in publishing, I understand the decision not to reprint. They can't sell the books, or they're afraid they can't sell the books. There's too much. Now, I would like to have them have that book out there on those things that says, you know, take an A4 for $2, because I want people to read my book. But they have to pay a full royalty on those books. They're only getting 50 cents for them, so it's not worth it. It's better for them to move the books that are in the warehouse. So, I mean, I understand the decisions, but that's why you fight. That's why you fight. And then there are some crazy authors who simply don't understand the business.
Mm-hmm.
I had a first novelist once who said, how much are you going to sell my paperback for? I said, I don't know. He said, well, E.L. Doctorow got, but I said, but you're not E.L. Doctorow. You know, it's, you know, people do come with some crazy stuff like that. I don't. I'm, of course, perfectly rational, although I have threatened to trash offices.
There's another aspect of your career I'd like to talk about. You have been doing some freelance work for Savvy Magazine, which is a fairly new, I think it's about 2 years old magazine for for executive women.
Yeah.
And a couple of your pieces have been about relationships, male-female relationships. Do you give advice or write features? I haven't had the chance to see the articles.
I got into this sort of thing because I spent a lot of time in bars. I used to. I haven't recently, but did when I was in New York. Everybody spends time in bars. And a lot of my friends are in the publishing industry, one of them is a woman who works for Savvy Magazine. And we got to talking about this business of whether or not a man should call a woman back after an encounter of some sort. And, you know, we sort of argued about it. And she said, well, why don't you write it down for us? And I said, okay. So I go home and I write it down. And lo and behold, they actually accepted it and printed it. And then we get all sorts of mail. So then we started looking at other things that I might say that might really get women mad. there was the old, you know, okay, you know, women get together as men do, but women especially talk and complain about men are terrible, but women, you know, guys say, chicks, man, you know, that's the... so to pick up some of those things that get said and look at it from the other point of view. The last piece I did was on long-distance relationships, which is a little bit more serious. So, but those first two were a lot of fun. Got a lot of mail.
Was it angry letters mostly?
There were usually two waves. The first one was there was a wave of letters about how I was a male chauvinist pig, and there was another wave of letters about how I was such a wonderful fellow and they wish they could meet me. So, you know, it sort of goes both ways. It's really fun.
Do they measure your popularity in terms of how many letters you get?
All magazines do. Uh-huh. That's the only thing they can...
Are male chauvinist pig letters as positive for feedback as I want to meet you letters?
It means
are?
People are reading the magazine. They don't care. They look at the advertising on the next page. You know, the magazine industry is really very strange.
Advice on the one on whether men should or do or shouldn't call women back after an encounter was reprinted in a South African.
No, actually, I don't think that was
that,
the one.
That wasn't
that
the
was
one?
The second one was called "Let's Just Be Friends," and it was about, you know, that statement. And gee, I really like you, Charlie, and it's wonderful to go out with you and have dinner and everything, but let's just be friends, you know. Let's not spoil it, you know, that's that whole thing. That was reprinted in Darling Magazine in South Africa, which I got a real kick out of. I think probably by now they know, so I won't be able to sell any more to South Africa. They paid very well, though.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah, for a reprint. They paid almost as much for the reprint as Savvy did to run it the first time.
What were you thinking when you found out it was published? What were your first thoughts?
In South Africa?
Yeah.
Oh, I just thought it was funny. Actually, my agent called me up and she said, I don't know whether you're going to want to do this. I said, of course I want to do this. You know, first of all, it's a justification of me as a writer. I mean, here I am. I can manage to suppress those things that are not relevant to a piece. I mean, we're talking about men and women. We're not talking about black men and anybody. And so that didn't show up and it was just fine for South Africa, which is what I would have wanted anyway.
Were you considering sending them a photograph afterwards?
No. Actually, I'm hoping they don't find out. Maybe they'll take the next one. You know, we sold that one to Australia, so it's nice.
So you're...
They're racist, too, so, you know.
So you're working on another novel now.
I'm working on it in the sense that the Ohio book is something I started in 73. And it's been sitting around, and, you know, every once in a while I'll touch it up a little bit, and it sort of grows. So I'm working on that. I'm working on a lot of other, magazine pieces are a lot of fun to do when they sort of take your mind off other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with your writing.
I need it.
Good luck with the award that you're nominated for also. Thank you for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
David Bradley has been my guest. He's the author of South Street and of a novel that was published a few months ago called The Cheneysville Incident. And this novel has been nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. The novel's published by Harper and Row. David Bradley is also an assistant professor of English at Temple University, where he also teaches a course on publishing. And he will be, by the way, one of the featured speakers this Saturday at the Free Library, which it starts at 1 o'clock. And there'll be a number of writers based in Philadelphia talking about the publishing industry, kicking around the idea of whether writers should or shouldn't be organizing a union. It's free and it's open to the public. That's this Saturday afternoon at the Free Library main branch on 19th and the Parkway at 1 o'clock. David Bradley, thanks again for talking with us. It's 5 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In about 5 minutes on Fresh Air, Francis Davis and John Zwed, Fresh Air's music critics, will be doing a special program about Thelonious Monk, who died last week. This is Charles Mingus. Charles Mingus is recording of Things Ain't What They Used to Be, and it's 2.5 minutes to three. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just want to remind you that at 4 o'clock today, making a return visit to Fresh Air will be Garrison Keillor, the host of A Prairie Home Companion, which we feature on WUHY every Saturday from 6 until 8. People have been asking all week when he will be making an appearance here at WUHY. It's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. He's got a new volume of short stories. The title is called Happy to Be Here, and we expect that he'll be able to read a couple of those stories for us this afternoon. We'll also be able to open up the phones, and we'll be inviting you to call with your questions or comments if you'd like to talk directly with Garrison. So that's coming up in an hour. Last week, pianist and composer Thelonious Monk died at the age of 61. We're going to present now a special one-hour edition of The Record Show. And joining John Zwed, the host of The Record Show, for this special edition is Francis Davis, who's the host of Interval, our Thursday afternoon jazz program. Francis and John are Fresh Air's music critics, and they've put together a special program in memory of Thelonious Monk.